a real deal. I'll shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
Mika, the Iceman. What's going on?
Hey, how are you? What is this? Recording in progress. Got it.
Now everybody knows and everybody can hear that crisp, crisp Finnish voice.
Yeah. Hey, I was wondering, since you have the Iceland flag there, are you watching? I'm assuming they're part of the European football tournament going on right now.
Euro. Oh man, yeah. Well, I haven't watched it, but like the dude was from Finland, wasn't he?
The guy who collapsed. Are you talking about that
guy? Yeah, the guy who collapsed with a heart
attack. He was Danish.
He's Danish. Okay.
His last name is Eriksson, I think. I think he's the best player for Denmark. So it's quite a. It was quite a hit for Denmark, and then you know Finland won the match 1-0. So it's, it's just too bad we had to win under those circumstances. But, you know, we'll still take the win. And it's great for Finland because it was their first game in this level of a tournament ever. Because we never played the World Cup. We never qualified because we played with, like, monsters from Europe. Like, we were in the same group with, like, Germany and England and, you know, a country like Denmark or Holland or Belgium. So it's been impossible. But this year, somehow, we qualified. I haven't really followed it that much, but I was happy to see them win yesterday. And I'm really happy to see that the guy was stabilized and nothing tragic happened. So that was excellent. But it was scary for a little while. And they obviously, the match was on hold and then they resumed it after like an hour.
Yeah, I actually read an ESPN report that said the Eriksson guy, he actually called up both teams and he's like, I want you guys to finish this from the hospital. So they ended up playing the game. According to ESPN, they ended up finishing out that game because he wanted them to, which is interesting.
That's nice. That's a nice thing to say. And that's not nice, you know, he obviously probably understood once he was stabilized that, you know, they're still a lot on the line, and you know it would be really a damper for the tournament if they couldn't finish that game or if they had to like call it even, you know, and both teams get a point. It's kind of weird, or they would have to resume later, which would like be substantial operational cost and just a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, I so, guess for anybody who hasn't heard, there was a soccer match yesterday that a player actually just collapsed in the middle of the game with a cardiac arrest, which was, I mean, you don't hear anything like that. So that's, I guess, what we're talking about. If you haven't heard, pretty weird situation, but doing well now, or at least stable.
It's happened before, but it's very rare. And
I know it happened in NBA basketball and a player actually died from it.
Yeah, and then obviously this guy's career is basically over. So he will not play. He's not going to play championship football. He might become like a expert commentator or like a coach. But I don't think. I think the doctors would advise against him playing against. I don't know if what we don't know exactly what the status is, but like. That could be in the worst case scenario, but anyway, he's alive, and you know, we'll see where it goes from there.
So, well, let's talk about the Iceman. Let's talk about Mika. You ready to get started with this?
Yeah, sure. We can talk about me.
So, the reason I wanted to bring you on, I guess for multiple reasons. Of course, I met you in Florida, and it was an absolute pleasure getting to meet you. So thank you for making me feel special while I was down there and hanging out with me and the rest of the crew. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was fun. That was a good little tournament, and obviously a great cause. So we did the working for the raising money for the Jeanette Lee's charity you know, so I'm sure that's still going on, and I still have the link on my Instagram. So anybody who hasn't followed me yet, you know, Iceman Mika, that's my Instagram. But then there's a link that you can click for the fundraising for Jeanette Lee, the Black Widow. So just had to plug that in there.
Absolutely. And it's a good fund. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that may have actually closed down now. I think she may have stopped it, but it was about 200 and I think they stopped at about 240,000. It was just shy of it, but that doesn't account a lot of the private stuff that was done. So I know, for example, I think the first time that they ran this event in Florida, I think they ran it was over almost $30,000 for that. That it wasn't put into the legacy fund, of course, because then you're going to be
right. That was a separate, like a private. And then, yeah, I think it was over 30,000 that first one.
So I'm guessing that she's pretty close to 300,000 for it, which is, you know, fantastic. I mean, the stuff that she's done for
it's amazing. And, you know, it's basically I'm sure, I'm not sure, but like part of it goes to the kids' schooling, and, you know, part of it could be some of the bills, hospital bills, who knows, but it's just all great to see how the whole world pulled together in that one. And, you know, that's how the word pool billiards started, like you pooling the money, right?
Yeah, something like that.
So anyway, it was nice to meet you there at the event. And yeah, it's good. Thank you for, you know, doing these events that you're doing online, because it was kind of the only thing that was really going on during the highest state of the pandemic.
Yeah, it was kind of it's weird to think about now that it's over. And for anybody who's not watching the video, I'm using air quotes. In the U.S., I mean, for the most part, it pretty much is. I mean, the rest of the world, it's kind of weird because, you know, they're still, you know, we're bringing on Alvin Ocean on Monday to talk, or I guess tomorrow to talk. And he's like, yeah, why not? I got nothing else to do. I'm in quarantine for the next 2 weeks. It's like, oh, that's kind of weird. I was just in Vegas last week and there was not a mask to be seen in the entire town. And everybody, you know, we went to Fremont Street and there was probably 500 people just within a half block radius, just packed together. And it's like, think going from Vegas and that to then saying Alvin is quarantining for 2 weeks. It's like two completely different worlds.
It's really is. And, it was really weird for us to go from the States to UK, and we had to stay in this. It was the bubble event for the World Championships, and we had to really quarantine and could only order food delivery, which we did a lot because. Sorry, but wasn't too impressed with the food in the bubble. Wasn't like, you know. I mean, it gets old after 2 days. So you just got to have a little variety. Yeah. And then we did the test on arrival. We did the test before leaving and a test on arrival. And then the second day test was kind of like plugged in there too. And then we had to do a test on the eighth day so that we can leave the bubble and we're like safe, you know.
Yeah.
So now we're, you know, now we're in London, and it's like sort of like feel a little bit of normalcy, just having, you know, can kind of walk down the street without a mask. But in stores here, they are still enforcing the use of mask, and which is probably smart, but we don't know the status. And there's been the so-called Delta variant here in the northwest of England that was. Some communities were hit pretty hard because they kept a route on Indian flights open for like some trade reasons and whatever. But I don't think it was very smart because it, you know, it can't justify any trade gains with loss of human life and, you know, other massive loss of in terms of like time, because everything gets pushed back. So like it's really a catch 22.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's anyway, here we go. It's just glad to hear that it's getting kind of normal, but it's also like some people, maybe people overreact to like the point where they start partying. It's like as if nothing's going on. So I don't know. It's just hard to say.
after a year, it's very easy to get into that mindset where it's like, all right, back to normal, let's party and celebrate. And it's, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's a little early, maybe it's not, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? It is nice to, you know, have that kind of like getting together with friends and being able to plan things without like, yeah, wait, what's like, and you know, but here it's still going on, unfortunately. And I hope, you know, we can kick it soon, and you know, the vaccinations gets distributed worldwide, and I think they got to start with like the hard hit areas to you know, mitigate it, and just people have to be smart in the meantime.
Very difficult thing to do. Very difficult.
Yeah.
So let's jump into Mika Immonen. So the first question I have, you're known as the Iceman. How'd you get that nickname? And was it something that you like to have right away, or did it just kind of get thrown on you? Because usually you don't give it to yourself, but maybe you did. So how did you get it? And did you like it at first?
Well, I mean, in the matchroom events, they were trying to like figure out some nickname, but they were, before they did, they were using some other guys' nicknames, like some rally drivers and like some ski jumpers and like, you know, hockey players from Finland. So I was like, I didn't want to use anybody else's nickname, especially if they're like famous person from Finland, like kind of like, eh, that's weird. But, and then so I wasn't like thinking about it too hard, but then when I was, I felt like you still really have to earn a certain status before you can kind of throw some nicknames in there.
Otherwise, I really agree with that too. I hate that everybody just gets one for no reason now, but
it's stupid. Like, I mean, especially if it's a cool nickname, like Iceman, I feel like you really have to earn it. You could be like, you know, you can have some kind of knucklehead nickname if you're just really a knucklehead.
Okay.
But so anyway, when I was playing the World Championships 2001, and I was, you know, kind of really playing on a very high level and very consistent, and I was like, they quoted some of the commentators like cool as ice, and it kind of like just dawned on me, well, you know, hey, if you can say that, you might as well call me Iceman. Because I thought about the movie Top Gun, where the role where Val Kilmer was this kind of stern character, but like very focused and very kind of, it seemed like maybe a little bit of a, he was very competitive. He came off to some people maybe a little bit of a dick, but turned out to be like a decent guy in the end, because he was just really just that focused and that he had that drive. So I was like, you know, you can just call me Iceman. I didn't want to be the Maverick, because it's like, yeah, it's a cool nickname, but also, I don't know, not as cool as Iceman.
I think Iceman's a good one.
Yeah, so I kind of just claimed it from there.
Yep. So let's go back to the origin. What got you actually into playing pool, and how did you kind of progress in the early years of your game towards, I guess, having a Hall of Fame career?
Well, I think, you know, bunch of us kids that were, you know, in a group hanging out, you know, we had a little, at one point I was playing basketball, but we played all like sports, football, we played hockey in the winter, pretty much the same crew all the time, but it's very like, you had a pretty good, everybody had a good competitive drive and like, you know, but of course it was fun too. To you know, go on a trip together, and you know, so we went to Norway one time, went to Germany on a team, and it was fun. And I just, you know, I did like traveling, and then, of course, eventually I saw the movies. I think I saw Hustler first. You know, I thought I was fascinated by the whole scene, and like Paul Newman obviously was a big idol for me, and his acting and, you know, his charisma really made an influence on me, and just like the whole American scene was kind of interesting, and
it hasn't changed.
Just hasn't changed much. And then Color of Money came on, and I was like, "What? Like, this is like okay. This is like a little bit more. Seemed a little bit more even realistic, or right, like in my era of things. Like, if that's the case, you know, that's maybe it could be something within reach. Because I'm talking about the competitive side, not the hustling side. Because that there was some real time characters, players that you know I got to meet. Eventually, and but I had this competitive drive because I'd all played all these games, and then eventually they open up the pool room just literally like maybe a quarter mile from my home. So between home and school was like a mile away, but like the pool room was a quarter mile away, so it was easier to gravitate towards that direction. But yeah, still had to go to school. But it was I spent a lot of time like after school at the pool hall, just you know, playing till you know I couldn't hold the stick anymore. Like basically just till they closed.
And how sometimes many of your even initial, after. Sorry, how many of your initial group of friends that you kind of played all your sports with? How many of them do you think made it over to follow you, or did any?
Not really, but some of them were like we were really close in the beginning, but then I kind of just progressed like a little quicker, and I got like more serious and started like going to like around the city, different clubs and club tournaments, and then eventually like regional, national, and you know yeah, it was just very like fast progression from there. I played Nordic championships and got a little travel bug there too, and just like was really excited to play and like go further and further in the game.
Yeah. So did you ever have a realization like this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life? And if you did, when did you have it?
You know, it was by the time I was 15 when I started, by the time I was 19, I was already like, you know, national, like men's champion. And, you know, that's, I guess now when I look at it, fairly young age. Back then I thought I was already like, oh, I'm an adult, but I was really a kid. But you know, when I was like 20, I was like, okay, maybe, you know, I was traveling. I went to Asia. I went to Taiwan first time in 1992, and that was kind of just like a culture shock, but still like it was all very exciting, and I did pretty good. I finished in like quarterfinals out of like this like hardcore professionals, like I mean a lot of top Americans was there, like all the top Asians, including like Efren Bustamante and all the Taiwanese monsters that had already like a pretty high gear at that time. Nick Varner was there. He was still very active. Like the day that I showed up at the, you know, the venue, everybody was like allowed to practice. I just, you know, got straight out off the bus off a 20-hour trip. And I saw Nick Varner. He ran like 250 balls in straight ball, like just right there. I'm like, okay, that's
whatever.
Normal.
Just another day in the office.
Yeah. And Nick ended up like actually getting into the finals of that first event. I was in the quarterfinals. I lost to Johnny Archer. I think it was the first time I played Johnny. Lost like, I think it was 9-6 or something like that. But it was all very like just fascinating to see, you know, different continent and play and see the common thread and connection that, you know, pool players still have. And, So I started playing the Euro Tour, you know, that same year, and managed to actually win the Euro Tour. I won the inaugural Euro Tour in Belgium, and then I won the tour that year. I ended up being the points leader, so that was kind of cool for a young kid. And you know, I remember going back home from the the final event was actually as an exciting place. Probably heard of Monte Carlo, right?
Oh yeah.
So that was the final event, and I finished second, but that put me in the lead for the year, and I was like, yeah, that was a great, pretty proud of that achievement. And then I got on the plane on the way back home, and then my friend that worked for Finnair, he had arranged, a bottle of champagne. So they called me like from the, not from the flight deck, but the flight, the purser, like the main flight attendant was like, Mika Imanen, can you just make yourself known to the crew? And then, congratulations. So I was like, what the hell? That's pretty cool. Surprised.
That's not usually an announcement you want to get when you're on a plane. Turned out to be okay.
I know. Just like, getting recognized was nice. And it was a nice gesture from a friend of mine, because it was very like, just kind of, he pulled a few strings to do that,
Yeah, for sure. So then that is that kind of the moment that you realized that not only you were going to be doing this, as a professional pool player, but you're kind of you're becoming one of the top of that, not only at the time, but that this game is really realized.
Well, I realized that like this could be really something, this could be a career, but it was also like, I realized that this is what I want to do. I want to travel. I want to see the world, and I want to play pool. And I felt like that year I was in terms of like my mental power, I felt like, I have a chance, although I knew my game was very beginning and I had a lot to learn, but I felt like, I can handle the pressure, because, I just, that's the way it is. It's just, you either got it or you don't.
Yep. And you're the Iceman, so you have to have it, right?
I had to. My early nickname was, they gave me this because I was super fast in the beginning of my career. Yeah, they gave me a hurricane. I was just like running around the table, just making everything. Just
the hurricane.
So I remember in the European pool magazine, the first time I got on the cover, it was like 92, obviously. And then they said the hurricane. So, which was very flattering, because Jimmy White, a famous snooker player from England, obviously, his nickname was the hurricane. So I was like, I'll take that, It wasn't another Finn, it was just, it was a snooker legend, which I looked up to all those guys, because I followed snooker too. And I played a little bit played a couple of years, but then 1992 I realized that pool is more my thing.
Yeah,
so I had to make a choice,
Yep. So let's actually get to like the bulk of your career now, because for maybe about a 7 to 8 year stretch, you're probably gonna, you're really gonna have to struggle to find anybody who reached like a higher high than you. I mean, you were winning just about everything for about a 7 year stretch, and the things that you weren't winning, you were right up near the top at. You're a multiple world time champion, you're a two-time back-to-back US Open champion, you've won straight pool champions, pool champ, or 8-ball championships, 9-ball, 10-ball, you play every discipline, and you've won just about anything. So before I ask what is your favorite, is there one tournament or one title out there that you look at and be like, man, I wish I could still win that one? I think that would be like the nail in my career. Is there one out there that you're still looking to get?
Yeah, I actually, I'm going to have to like win a few tournaments before I get invited back into the World Pool Masters. That's one thing that I got. I was in the final against Alex 2008. Like you said, if I wasn't winning, I was close. But, it was weird. We played that 3-point rule, and I remember being up 6-3, and I hit a really hard break, made a ball. The one ball hits the point in the middle, goes back down table, and I don't make the 3 points. And then they award to, it's Alex turn on the table, and he puts like a 4 or 5 pack. Anyway, the next time I got a shot, Alex was up 7-6. And it's a long shot, and I was I didn't know how to handle it. I don't know. It was just weird. I felt like a little bit robbed, like, you know, up 6-3, making a ball, hitting it hard. And next thing you know, you have a tough shot. You're down 7-6, and it was raised to 8. Boom, done.
Yep.
So World Pool Masters, I don't know. I've had like weird luck in that event. Like sometimes, like many times lost first round. One time I got Marcus Chamat, he made like 3 9s on the break. And one of the 9s that didn't go, it was in the hole and it was like a straight combo. And it was just like disgusting. But
the joys of 9-ball.
Yeah. It would be nice to win that tournament still. And I aim to get back in form and get back on the scene big time. And I obviously, you know, if they're not going to invite me, I have just like, you know, I have to just make my way.
Yep.
And then where they just don't have the option but to invite me. Sometimes you just gotta, like, you can't wait, you know, outside the door and knocking, and you just have to, you know, kick the door in. So, but obviously it takes a little bit of hard work and some results.
So you have a very, very, very storied career. I mean, I think the best way of describing your career in, you know, just one statement is you're in the BCA Hall of Fame at age 41, and you cannot even get onto the ballot until you're 40 years old. Am I wrong in saying that you were the youngest ever inducted you were the youngest ever? Am I wrong in saying that?
I am actually not sure. You would have to.
I thought I heard that once, and I think it might be true, but
might be one of the youngest, but like also Jeanette was pretty young when, you know, she's not much older than me, and she got in a year before me. So like, I don't know. It's pretty, pretty close, but I was actually on the ballot and she beat me by one swing vote the year that I was like instantly when I was 40. So the fact that I didn't make it that year, okay, fine, you know, ladies first. And I got in the next year, which was just as great, you know?
Yeah. So that's pretty crazy impressive. I mean, that's the best way, but let's take a look at your entire career. What are, if you had to rank maybe your top 3 or 4, you maybe 5 if you want to go that deep, of the best victories that you've had, so meaning the best championship?
I mean, the first one would always have to be the first world championship.
So 2001?
2001 in Cardiff, and I beat Ralph, who was like really tough to beat at that time. He was like crazy in the 90s, and that was like, he was still, you know, the surgeon, basically just the Kaiser. So it was just great to have that tournament, like kind of like just be in the zone that whole week and beat Ralph with a pretty good margin, 17-10, and realizing that one of your dreams that you always wanted, you always dreamed of and worked hard for, has been realized. And it's just like, I was like overwhelmed with like joy and like emotional. I was very emotional because it was just like, it's I'm here. I'm that's it. Like, you know,
and then
it was just the, of course it was the beginning of my career still, but it was just great. And, you can't, I haven't had that feeling ever since, but you know, there's been a lot of great tournaments after.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that the Corey Duell soft break year too for the U.S. Open?
That's right.
So I think about it. I mean,
such a contrast.
Yeah, right.
I had a good run there, and then I played on the outside tables. That played kind of tough, and you know, but like, yeah, Corey did the soft break, and it, you know, he was allowed to do it, and it was kind of, in my opinion, a little bit ridiculous.
It's a little sketchy to say the least.
I don't think it made the game look good. So
yeah, and he ended up the score line was pretty one-sided on that, but he didn't, if I'm not mistaken, what was the final score of that match? You played him in the finals.
I didn't. I got zero.
Yeah, I think it was 11-0, was it? And yeah. You can go back and watch this. I'm sure it's on YouTube somewhere. But he was hitting the racks maybe 7 miles an hour.
Well, the one ball barely made it to the side pocket.
Yeah, maybe 7 miles an hour. Maybe even less.
I don't know.
Five miles. Yeah. And so basically he was just poofing the rack. The wind
ball. I can definitely run faster than he hit the QPL.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of a controversial one. Of course, and that was only, Corey's only U.S. Open. But you end up getting back and winning it twice. But if you think about it, if you would have won the World Nine Ball and the U.S. Open in the same year, I mean, that's welcome to legend.
that would have been super nice. And it's just like, it's just too bad that it was taken in that way. Yeah. Like, with a stupid soft break. I mean, I'm never going to change my mind about that. I think it's silly that was allowed to happen, like in terms of like, I mean, Barry Berman could have just said, we're just going to enforce a hard break. So you just deal with it,
Yeah. Yeah. So your number one win you think is the 2001 world title. Is there any other things that you think would be on a list or that you're super proud of?
I mean, I had if we talk about like some not so fun things that happened in my career, was like 2006 when I missed the nine to win the Moscone Cup for Europe. And it was a weird year because, still we had a match left and David, I think David Alcaid ended up losing to another guy. So it wasn't like, obviously it's the team, effort, and it's not only my fault that we lost, but I know I had the chance for the winning nine and I missed it, and so that kind of like haunted me for a while.
And that was when the U.S. was kind of dominating too.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, we had a chance to like really get in there, and a little earlier eventually we did start dominating back, but like
much to my chagrin,
I was really depressed after that one, and I didn't make the team the next year, which was like, I felt like it was, whatever. It's just, that's the way it is. And so I really had to fight my way back on the team in 2008 when I got in and I finally redeemed that, I got that monkey off my back by getting the MVP and like playing a pretty stellar tournament and actually sinking the winning nine ball against SVB, which was obviously the icing on the cake. So it was nice to be able to do that. And that was definitely one of the finest moments of my career. And but there's other times, like, when I was on that crazy run between 2008 and 2009, winning things left and right, and then being able to cap the 2009 with the end of the year tournament World 10 Ball Championships in Manila. Manila is like the Mecca for pool. I mean, everybody has to make a pilgrimage. If you're a serious pool player, you have to make a pilgrimage there and just like get your some elbow grease in there, get your, hands dirty and just go gamble against the local guys and see where
a bunch of money to the local taxi driver.
See where it takes you, because there's not a whole lot of guys that just went there and, robbed them. So, it's just it's a good challenge, but it's really fascinating to see the level of play and the depth of the field there, because you had so many guys you've never seen before that can like really shoot lights out. So it was wonderful to be able to win in Manila, because I was already a household name because I won the 2001 at the maybe the height of popularity in pool. I mean, the whole 2000s decade was crazy in Manila. I mean, I went there like probably like 20, who knows, maybe 20 different tournaments, but I went there several other times just because it was just, I made friends there and I, it was just a good pit stop, and it was just really great. And I remember like them asking, like, in the press conference at 2009 World 10 Ball, like, you know, what's your strategy, or what's your secret, what do you attribute to your success? And I was just like, you know what, you just gotta keep doing the same things, you gotta work hard and have the humility, but also have the confidence in your skills, and, like, you know, just know that it's not, you know, if you get lazy, you're not going to get there. And it was really amazing to win that. A good birthday present for myself.
So trivia.
December.
Trivia. What's for that? Yourself. Speaking of the Moscone Cup, there are two people who have ever had in the world more Moscone Cups. Can you name them? And how many do you have? Let's see your Moscone Cup trivia.
I would say Johnny Archer is probably, he's been in maybe more than myself. I would say maybe he's been in 17 times. I don't know. I could be wrong.
Pretty good.
And if I'm not mistaken, maybe Ralph is there. But he's not 17. He might be like 16 or 15.
He is 17 as well. Him and Johnny are tied.
Yeah, 17 as well.
And you have how
many?
Okay,
so they're tied for the most, and I have 15 as far as I know.
15. And there, well, since you're so good at Moscone Cup trivia, let's see if you can name this. There are three players who have ever had multiple MVPs at the Moscone Cup. Can you name all three of them?
Well, Niels is an easy Niels. Pick.
And, second easiest pick, I would say.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know I have two
of course
MVPs. Which is kind of bizarre, because the first MVP I got was when we were part of the losing team. But I think I won all my games, I don't know, maybe it was like a consolation MVP that year, because it didn't feel that great, obviously, being part of losing. But that was probably the only time that a losing team a guy from the losing team was awarded the MVP. So still, it's an achievement. well, I mean, the other one has to be it's Skyler.
Yep, Skyler. Yep. Pretty good. That's pretty good.
yeah. I mean, and I know my Moscone.
Yeah. So, all right, let's talk about what do you think you played the best ever? Can you go back and look at one pool tournament and be like, that's the best I've ever played from start to finish? My guess would be the second U.S. Open that you won would be my guess.
I'm not sure, because I lost one match, but like, if you look at the whole scope of event, you know, things that were transpiring, it's like, it's a pretty good guess, because I won 14 matches in a row.
14 straight matches. He lost his very first match.
To defend the title.
Yes, to defend. He lost his very first match and then won 14 straight.
Yeah, that's something that might not ever be repeated again.
I don't see how it can't be. maybe it's a little bit easier now, because the last 16 is a single elimination. So it's a little bit easier. I mean, it takes away, five matches on the B side?
Well, that's what I mean. It won't be repeated because of the fact that
the
last 16 they won't be the amount of matches are not there. It's just not possible.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty crazy achievement, actually. That's one of the highlights. There's gotta be like 10 different highlights of my career. You know, that's one of them, definitely.
Yeah. So is there one person in your career that every time that you played against him, you're like, yes, this is a walkover, no problem, on to the next match, because you just have their number? And then vice versa, is there one player that every time you play against him, you're like, crap, how am I going to get through this match? So one rival and one player that you just loved playing against.
Well, I love to play. I don't necessarily say I love to play, but I had a pretty, like, a great run with Earl. And
something about that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I actually, like, I kind of had his number at some point, because I think it was like maybe from 2007 to like some, for like a 12-year, I don't know, it was like 11 or 12-year period. I beat him like 20 times in a row. Like, he actually beat me once in that period, but it was at a tournament where I made it back through the loser's bracket in the final, and I beat him in the finals.
Okay.
So I feel it kind of like, it doesn't count, because I still beat him in the same tournament and knocked him, you know, he this is a final. So, like, if you could, like, count that as just a solid win.
Yeah, then it's your podcast, you can make the rules.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, okay, I didn't, like, there's one win there, but, like, it's kind of, I got back in a major way in the same tournament, so kind of like just equals each other out, or but like the balance shifts in my favor. So it's kind of like, you know, tug of war there that,
yeah,
that I win. But then I gotta say, as far as guys that have a good record against me,
my guess would have been Ralph. And I don't know if he has a good record as far as his career.
Well, yeah, I don't know if, you know, we could. The thing is that I beat Ralph in every major that I played against him in the final.
Okay.
So even if he beat me some other times, I don't know. I can't really say he didn't have my number, because I beat him in the finals. That kind of washes that off. But Bustamante was hard to beat. Like, he was very hard to beat.
That guy's still hard to beat.
He's still very hard to beat.
Yeah, he's timeless, seemingly. I mean, that.
Although I got him couple of times pretty good, but he's one that was like really just phenomenal, especially in like the beginning, like my early career, like in the 90s. It was just like scary. His level was scary.
Yeah, actually, yeah, it's like you had to see Warren, kind of having a resurgence now.
What's that?
Warren Kiyomko's kind of having a resurgence right now. He's won, I think he's won three big events in the U.S. in the last month. It's another name that these people are just
Warren's
timeless.
Interesting. Yeah, he didn't, like, in the 2000s, he was kind of like just like whatever, you know.
He was from Philippines,
but he was good, but he was just, he didn't have a gear like he's hit like lately. Maybe, you know, yeah, we're obviously seeing what he's really capable of truly now. And it's just interesting, that kind of nice to see that, you know, for him. And yeah, he's no spring chicken, you know, though it's, you know, spring rooster, but, you know.
So the real reason I wanted to bring you on, of course, from besides just getting to chat with you and get your story out there a little bit more to the listeners, was I wanted to get your opinion. You've been around since, you won your first world title in 2001, and now you've played in this world pool title, world pool championship, I should say. It's kind of been rebranded. And that was 20 years ago that you won your first one. I wanted to kind of get your opinion on where you've seen the evolution of this event go. Because, of course, this year is, I'm young, I'm only 7 years old, but I've never seen a world title exactly quite, at least presented this way. And I think it was an interesting thing to bring on somebody like yourself, who's probably played in 25 or 30 of them, and get your opinion on where you see the direction of this event going, and what you kind of thought of this event as a whole.
Well, I just it's nice to see that Matchroom showed interest to run the event again, and they've been on a hiatus ever since. Not sure when the last ran an event in Manila. It was maybe 2007 or 8, and then for 12 years it was in the Middle East and didn't really get the coverage it deserves, because very limited, like, you know, availability for viewers, and I guess you could say limited possibilities in terms of sponsorship, and it was just different, obviously. And then now it has a chance to be the major, more major event it deserves to be, because it should always be on like major networks, and I think it should be available for, like, luckily it's available on DAZN in the States, you know, for viewers in America. So, but it, you know, I wish there was more streaming opportunities, and, you know, and yeah, Matchroom does a great job, you know, running their events, and this was no exception.
Yeah, so there was a couple of new additions to it. This was the first time the Predator table was ever used, really even seen. What did you think of the new Predator table?
Yeah, it played pretty good, actually. Like, it was not like super tight, but it was also, you know, it was different. So you had, like, down the rail, you couldn't hit the ball really hard. If you hit it into the rail, it would, like, rattle and spit it out. But, and I like the fact that it doesn't just, if you hit it bad, it won't just die and rattle and stay in the pocket. It actually kind of sometimes spit it out, and, which is different from diamond. I like the table. It's hard to see how well the table plays when it gets a little bit more used, but, like, in terms of how it played when it was new like this, it seemed to roll very straight. It was good leveling. And then I like the size of the pockets, and it was presentable. So totally, I wouldn't mind playing them on those tables again.
All right. So we can move on from most of the event, unless there's anything else you want to say as far as, like, the broad scope of things for the event.
I mean, yeah, it's just it's a shame that we weren't able to see a lot of the top guys that would deserve a chance to be there. Like, a lot of Filipinos weren't there. I mean, we did have, obviously, De Luna and Gomez, who are deservingly there, but we're missing, you know,
so many.
I mean, you have, like, Orcolo, we have
Beato,
we have Levin Corteza, Busti still act, like, you know.
Yeah, there's, you can almost fill the entire field. Johan Chua. Yeah.
I mean, there's like
Rolando Garcia.
10 Filipinos that should be there. And then there's a few Taiwanese players, Taiwanese and Chinese.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they can't get there because of the restrictions. But yeah, I mean, there's.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it was almost like a European championship with a few invited extra players.
Yeah, with just a few. Few Middle Eastern players, a couple of American players, and that's about it. Yeah, a couple, an Australian. I don't think there was anybody from, like, New Zealand or anything like that. I think the only only Oceania player was blank on his name. The best or the top player from Australia. Well, neither here nor there.
Yeah.
So yeah. So let's take a second and talk about your career as you see it right now. I know you said that you still want to get back in the Whirlpool Masters. You would love to give yourself a second chance or third chance, you know, however many chances left of winning that event. Where do you see your career as of right now? And how has that changed since the Whirlpool Championships?
Well, yeah, 20 years is a long time. And, it, you know, in anyone's life and maybe career. But I still, I love the game. I'm still going to be active, and I just got to work extra hard. And I'm really excited to hear about Matchroom. You know, they're hosting the U.S. Open in Atlantic City, September 13 to 18, which is really exciting news that we're, you know, getting the U.S. Open back on the agenda, and it's especially for like New Yorkers and anybody from Northeast, it's a good boost for the pool business in general. And you know, I feel like the East Coast deserves a little, you know, a shot in the arm like this. We really needed something like this, and it's been a long overdue. So just excited for that. I'm gonna really gunning hard for that one. I'm gonna work super hard to do well, and of course my goal is to win another US Open, and you know, that would be perfect to do it there.
And I'm gonna be there, so I can even follow you around, and man, I can cheer for you. I'll even bring pom poms if you want.
Yeah, that'd be nice, you know. you guys can both wear skirts, and you know.
Yeah, I'm not above doing that. I'm not above doing that, Mika.
All right. Well, anyway. Some other cheering equipment, and you know.
Yeah. So
the professional.
the people on the Patreons are going to be able to see the patches that you have on your chest there, and this is the jersey that you wore during the World Pool Championships. Why don't you take a second and talk about some of those companies and your relationship with them?
Well, still, it hasn't been washed, so it's got a little, you know, personal,
yeah,
you know, whatever. But I decided to wear it because I'm a professional still, and then I might as well, you know, put the logos out there. So we have obvious Mez here. I've been with them 17 years, and you know, it's a great product. It's one of the leaders in the industry. They really quality is second to none. And want to like thank Matchroom for this, you know, what they're doing to pool, and you know, I'm still around, so
don't forget about me.
I want to get some TV time, man. I gotta get back on the scene. So and then we have Bode Research, which is a, you know, this some kind of a consulting company based out of Canada, but you know, May is highly involved with that, with a business associate, Ranjan. And, you know, they decided to support me in this you know, venture, or, you know, this avenue that I'm still walking on. So hopefully they can grow and I can grow with them, and, you know, we can grow whatever. It's just a lot of growth. It's all good. And then I have Taum, which is the billiard product company from Finland that I'm partners of. And that's, you know, that's excellent. You have the Taum Pro Tip. Have you had a chance to try it?
I have not had a chance to try it yet. Unfortunately, okay,
so
I have not.
You gotta stick it on your stick and, you know, just figure it out and enjoy it. And, you know, we've also, like with Taum, not only do we have good tips, but playing tips that we've introduced lately, and that's the Fusion. You know, that's really that's a kind of a more firm hit, but still grippy. So you still get action, but it's a little bit more firm. But aside from that, we have the break and jump tips that have been used for a lot of like top professionals. You'll be surprised, you know, maybe like 60 or 70% of the top pros use Taum on their break stick. So yeah, this competition's tough. There's a lot of guys that are introducing new products and try to do something similar, but I feel like we still got the lead on that in terms of like performance, you know, grip and power combined, which is, you know, kind of hard to do, because sometimes when you put grip, it means it has to be softer, but the Tom, it still provides power and control. So, and very proud of the chalk that we have introduced. The Pyro is like the latest addition to the products in the line, and it really is great for any game. And we have some new prototypes coming up on the scene. The next one, I believe I'm allowed to say.
Yeah, come on, let's hear some teasers. Come on.
Yeah, it's called, we have this green, light green chalk, and it's going to be called V10.
V10. So, oh, I'm going to have to sue you. That's too close to VG10. Just kidding.
Really? It's just V10, man. It's like the engine.
Where's the ghost?
You know?
No virtual ghost 10 ball? No, I'm just kidding.
No. We won't, like, we'll collaborate. We won't compete.
There we go. I would love to do that. You know, I'm always looking to make friends.
Yeah, so I'm excited for these new products. And it's really, I have to say that I wish in pool, they haven't really realized the benefits, because it's, you know, the conditions are different from like snooker and maybe carom, but snooker players, obviously, like maybe 95% of the players are using Tom, because it just keeps everything clean.
Yeah.
And the performance is great. And you never get a bad, you won't get a bad hit, basically, virtually never. So, and those kicks, when they happen, it can cost you a lot of money, because it might cost you the tournament, because it's might come down to that one bad contact, and then, you know, you don't end up getting a good run, and it could be a deciding factor in a match. So for those who haven't tried Tom, it's not just it's not some herbal legend. It's already a legend.
So here's my personal endorsement. And for full disclosure, Tom has never sent me a tube of chalk or anything like that. So this is just my personal opinion on it. When I give lessons and we are talking about cue ball striking, and we always want to be able to see the chalk mark on the cue ball, I actually will not allow people to use Tom, because you cannot get that thing to make a mark on the cue ball. It just is so clean. It does not go into the cue ball at all. So I actually have to pull their chalk away from them and make them use a master or a, you know, a silver cup, whatever is there, so that they can actually get a mark on the cue ball, so that we can actually have that consistency to find out where they think they're striking and where they're actually striking. So
yeah,
we can start working towards building.
You should have a separate driving range for that kind of stuff, but you should keep it away from the pool table, the other pool, the real pool table. So,
yeah.
Just saying.
So there's my personal endorsement for the Tom chalk. It's it's so clean, you can't even use it to mark up the balls with if you're trying to. So,
yeah, I mean, it's been proven, and you know, even like a guy who does those independent studies, Dr. Q or something, he really like studied the hit, and you know how much the Tom is, if it's on the contact point, if it gets throw, and it gets less throw, and it part, you know, it doesn't really make the ball bounce at all. So it's just like, it's clean hit, and it's been proven over and over again. And then, you know, obviously a top player, you would know, if you're a really top player and you think there's another chalk that's better, just prove it. It hasn't been like beaten yet, so it's just quite kind of a revolutionary product, which is, we're very proud of. And being from my home country, Finland, this guy Tony Ursin, his name, he's really a inventor, kind of like a real tinkerer, you know. He comes out with these products, and he's just really fantastic guy, and it's just nice to be part of that team.
Yep. So you have, I think that Tom is kind of an interesting story on how you guys got the name. Did you want to talk about that real quick before we move on?
Yeah. So the initials TAOM are, it's an abbreviation of all the names on the team. So we have four partners, and Tony stands for T, obviously, and he's the main man. And then the rest of them are not in like order of any importance, but you know, whatever.
It's hard to, Ollie come up with a real like, name with an M next to a T.
Right. Anyway, so Ollie, he's like Tony's like childhood friend, and he's like he's you know, right hand basically, and they work a lot of the elbow grease back at the factory. They, you know, between the molds and stickers, and they try to introduce new better products and doing their research. And but you know, they run the lab and they run the factory, and you know, I don't know, I'm sure there's, you know, their wives are also like, you know, doing printing labels and doing the run to the post office and this and that. It's very hard work, but they're very occupied and very proud of what they do. So that was Ollie. And then O stands for often, and which is like my fellow professional Jonas, as some Americans say, but in Finland it's pronounced Jonas Ohtonen. So his last name is Ohtonen, but he's mostly, you know, some guys in Finland, some people get called by their last name. It's pretty normal. And he's been like predominantly always referred as Ohtonen for some reason. And we decided to use the O there. The J would have been harder anyway, but it really worked. And then the M for Mika. And we played around with a bunch of, we had the initials, right? We were trying to figure out some words, and we found out that Tom is a Scottish word for a, like, some kind of inspirational, like a war thing, like Tom, like, I don't know, a war cry. So they use that in the battle, and that's the kind of theme we got.
I think it's a better name than Moat. So
yeah, Moat. Adam. Adam could have been a, but it's too geeky. So I'm thinking Tom is good. You know, it's unusual, and it's fairly easy to pronounce, and you know, it has a good Tom story.
Taeom. I hear lots of Taeom, but
yeah,
even Taeom sounds kind of cool.
Taeom sounds good. If you don't want to, you want to do the A in an E. I don't know. Depends where you are, what country you're in, I guess. But in Finland, it's Taeom, and it, you know, it's still easy to repeat, right? So is what it is.
All right. So I guess the last question I'll get you out of here with is one, what would you give for somebody coming up right now? Because of course, this is a little bit different now than it was 25 years ago when you were coming up and really making a staple on this industry. What would your advice be for somebody coming up right now to have a long succeeding career? And then if you want to give a couple suggestions of the people out there that you see that are coming up right now that impress you, maybe you could give a couple people that you think are good ambassadors for the game going forward.
Well, obviously you have to work hard and, you know, try not to burn too many bridges on the way, and, you know, treat your sponsors with loyalty and treat people with respect, and do your research on, like, you know, the mental side of the game, which is you're not going to learn everything by just playing. You have to also study some books on the topic. You know, I've read a lot of books when I was coming up, and then kind of, you know, like different champions, they have their biographies, or they have, like, you know, instructional books or videos, and just study what they have to say. And you know, like an inner game of golf, it's still the same principles are there. I mean, something that might resonate you from a guy that's a coach for like a ping pong team might resonate you better than the guy that's coaching an archer or a, you know, somebody else. That it's still some of the principles the same, but you still have to like figure it out yourself and see what resonates to you. And I think it's fascinating side of the sport, because it is so mental, you know, like at the end of the day, when you're like on top of the world in terms of your seasoning and talent and the way you see the game, perceive the game, you still have to be mentally strong. And if you haven't, you need extra tools. You need a lot of tools in your artillery to be able to phase, you know, certain situations. And so you have to like study the game, study the other games and see what resonates and move forward and set goals, you know, set timelines, set goals. And, you know, like I said earlier, you can't keep knocking on the door. You have to like just kick the door in sometimes. I like to think I don't want to, if you're like thinking when you're in the finals that this is the final, sometimes you get this. I've noticed that there was a time when I was reaching the finals a lot, but then I was losing and I was like trying to figure it out. What was the thing? So like, if you can just, obviously, you know, it's the final, but like you should treat the final the same, the way you treat the first match of the event. So it's kind of like, you have to do some mental tricks sometimes just to kind of deceive yourself, just to like have that maintain that even concentration and not giving, you know, the fact that it's a final too much respect. You just have to have that steady flow, you know, try to find the zone.
I think that's pretty
sometimes it's better to think that the first match of the next event is the final, because it's just as important.
Yep. That one resonates with me. I have a very good track record of getting second places in big events. So that one strikes home right here.
Yeah. It's just like sometimes when the goal is so close, you get distracted. So it's important to, you know,
look at all that reach, silver.
You got to reach further than the final to just, you know, just keep going. You got to have that pace where you can just like crush the finish line and not just crawl over it.
So then is there anybody that you see out there in the game today that, that you think is a good embodiment of what you just said?
Well, I mean, Albin Ocean is on a pretty impressive run. He's won a lot of matchroom events, and he's raking in the cash. So he must be feeling pretty good right now, like totally like making it rain. Probably, you know, if he wasn't in quarantine, I'm sure he would make it rain. But like,
yeah, right.
Saves right. A lot of money, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
But hey, all jokes aside, he's on a phenomenal run, and he's a very steady player. He's like the Steady Eddie. I don't know. You should give him another nickname. I'm not sure what his nickname now is, but
yeah, does he have a nickname? I don't think he.
I don't remember it. He had a nickname. They mentioned it. Yeah, he's great. I was surprised to see Shane get knocked out to the, you know, Hungarian kind of upstart, you know, career-wise. I've never even seen the guy before.
Slonecki,
he's like early 20s, and he won 10 racks in a row against Shane, and he could be a force in the, you know, near future if he can, you know, handle it. And because it doesn't really matter how good you are, we won't know how good you are until you know, prove it at later in when you win the championships. So you could be a practice champion, but it doesn't matter. You got to still
and then claim on to the titles. And Francisco Sanchez Ruiz right afterwards. I mean, that's another scalp worth having. Francisco's a beast.
Oh yeah, totally. It was amazing to see that run from him to make it in the finals with, you know, that little amount of seasoning that the kid had.
The semifinals.
I mean, I was like,
I think he had Omar down 6-1 too.
Thinking like, No, but I thought if he made it to the final, I mean, that would have been scary. But I think Albin is just playing so steady that it's hard for anybody to beat him. Omar got close. I'm very proud of him. He's been working hard, and I like the guy. Really, really cool guy. And I thought he almost had it when he was up 9-7, and he just played a safe and the cue ball. If it just ran one more rotation, Albin would have been in a big jam. Locked up, and he couldn't play that jump shot he performed so perfectly. So, yeah, he really clinched it in the end, and he played phenomenal, and he deserved it. So, and it was nice to see the ladies do well. Veronica, I can't pronounce her last one. Forgot the last name.
I'm not trying.
But she Kelly played phenomenal. She cut a couple of good scalps, and she's got really good form. So I was impressed with her game and the maturity of her game, because she makes the right shot selections, and Jasmine played great.
I was going to say, did you watch Yasmin's and Jeff DeLuna's match by chance?
I did not watch that.
So
it would be interesting to see.
Yeah, I think Yasmin was up 4-0 or maybe even 5-0. And you could see that the wheels are just coming off. Like, she can't make a ball. She can't make a safety. She's imploding right in front of our eyes. And she gets, I think Jeff gets back to like 6-6. And then she runs out of the last two racks. Like, she pulls herself together, shakes herself off, and just runs up from everywhere again.
That's crazy. That was
great. And Jeff is dogging his brains out the entire time. So even when he's, he'll be dogging balls, and then she comes up and just gives it right back. And you can just see she's getting more and more and more frustrated. And then she just settles in and just right back.
Well, Jeff was a little probably not expecting Jasmine's performance, and maybe a little shell shock. But listen, I have to end this interview now because I have to run, catch dinner with my buddy Raj, and
Raj.
And so,
what a character that guy is! I love him.
Yeah, he's a character. Enjoy time with him. He's got a real gift of the gab, and he's all around character. So.
Well, send Raj my best wishes, and thank you very much for joining us for the podcast today. It was an absolute pleasure.
All right, cheers. Yeah. Hey, thanks, see you soon. Bye.
Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. If you've liked what you've heard and you want to contribute to the future content that will be made, consider joining the podcast's Patreon at www.patreon.com/queueitup. Becoming a Patreon of the podcast will help to create all of the future content that the podcast will have. Special shout out to Dave Peters, Aaron Taylor, Pete Silsby, Morgan Lupton, Ben Young, Robert Miller, Andy Morse, and Bill Pelham for your generous contributions to the podcast's Patreon. If you ever need any more information on what the Patreon system is or how you can contribute outside of the Patreon, please reach out to the podcast or Nate himself. If you would like to contribute to the podcast for free, consider sharing any podcasts or the podcast page on Facebook itself. Also, leaving a review and a rating if you listen through iTunes. It helps others find the podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Cue It Up podcast.